Hey, this is Kyle and Claire, and we're here with an important announcement. Starting in March, we will be transitioning from a weekly podcast to a bi-weekly podcast. Our episodes will still be released on Sunday nights just every other week.
This gives us more time with the content that we cover, and we're looking forward to having the opportunity to refine our segments. It'll also give us time to create other content, such as videos and blog posts.
We hope you guys enjoy the new format, and we're really looking forward to it. So thanks for listening, and enjoy the episode. Hello, I'm Kyle Willoughby. Joining me is Claire White.
Hello.
And this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerdman. We're here to discuss new nerd creations, how they were made, and explore the roots of the characters and the stories. And today, we are talking about the healing powers of interpretive dance.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise known as the OA. The OA is a Netflix original series that was released on December 16th, 2016. It was produced and created by Zal Batman-Glitch and Britt Marling. It was directed by Zal Batman-Glitch and stars Britt Marling. The OA concerns the reappearance of Prairie Johnson, a girl who has been missing for 7 years, who, when she vanished, was blind, but has returned with sight. The series deals with trauma, PTSD, near-death experiences, and narrative, actually, is one of the big focuses of the show. The show mostly consists of Prairie, who's played by Marlene, telling the story of her captivity to a group of mostly high school boys. There's also a strong element of fantasy and science fiction, and the question of what is the afterlife is, like, kind of the centerpiece, I feel like.
Yeah. That was a good summary, Kyle.
Thank you.
I especially liked where you pronounced Zal. I can't even pronounce it.
Batman Glitch.
Yeah, that was really good, too.
Think Batman Glitch.
Batman Glitch.
Batman Glitch. Mm-hmm. Exactly. My summaries are quite good these days. Claire will be talking about NDEs, or near-death experiences, in her segment, and I'll be talking about Zal and Marlene and, you know, kind of how they met and how they started working together. So, Claire, why don't you take it away and tell us more about near-death experiences, which I'm super excited about, actually.
So, this show kind of centers around a person who has had a near-death experience and other people who have had near-death experiences and what they mean, which is a huge discussion right now in the real world. For those who don't know exactly what it is, a near-death experience is defined by the Merriam-Webster Dictionary as an occurrence in which a person comes very close to dying, has memories of a spiritual experience, such as meeting dead friends and family members or seeing a white light, during the time when death was near.
So, Claire, is a near-death experience, like, does that mean, like, you have no pulse or brain activity, or is there a basic definition?
Undefined.
Undefined?
And I'll get into why that's so hard to define later.
Okay, cool.
So, people have experienced NDEs, as I'm going to refer to near-death experiences, across cultures and religions. And almost uniformly, people describe it as being an out-of-body experience, passing through a tunnel, a river, or a door to a warm, glowing light, maybe seeing dead loved ones, and being called back to their bodies and being told it's not their time to go. Now, some people believe this shows that the spirit and the body can be separated. People who have had near-death experiences tend to have side effects like heightened sensitivity to light, sound, certain chemicals, becoming more caring and generous, which apparently can be very taxing on loved ones, having trouble with time management and finance management, feeling unconditional love for everyone, and sometimes having a strange influence on electrical equipment.
Really?
Yeah, really. There was an NDE conference where I think a bunch of electrical equipment went haywire. And, like, the interviewer was talking to the person in charge, and they were like, well, you get a bunch of NDEers in a room. Something like that's bound to happen.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's crazy. I read, actually, and I really like this, how it's been compared to a hero's journey, which is what a lot of legends and
narrative stories are based on.
Harry Potter's a hero's journey. Yeah. Lord of the Rings is a hero's journey.
Star Wars.
Hero's journey. The first four, at least.
Yeah.
I mean, the first three. The original three, yeah. I should say. Where the hero is usually reluctantly shaken out of his or her normal way of life and strikes out on a journey to an unfamiliar realm. The hero faces tests, battles, withstands a climactic ordeal, almost fails, and then returns where he or she began. But now they're transformed. People are almost always profoundly changed and have trouble fitting back into their life. There's a lot of cases of people leaving their jobs, leaving their spouses, you know, because they've been changed by this traumatic experience.
Yeah. There's Oliver Sacks has a book called Musicophilia, which is about music's effects on the brain. But one of the first times I remember reading about an NDE was a doctor who was struck by lightning, was medically dead for like 6 minutes, was brought back. And when he came back, he all of a sudden just really wanted to learn classical music. And he'd never really been interested in music before that. And it possessed his life. Like, he divorced his wife, he kind of left his family, and he just went to learn how to play piano and write classical music.
From what I've read, that sounds like a very classic NDE response, yeah. Or response to having an NDE.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do a little bit of the history of NDEs. The oldest NDE in Western literature comes from Plato. Book 10 of his Republic, he tells the story of a soldier who was killed in battle. And 10 days later, when the bodies of all the other dead were being collected, the other dead were corrupted, but Ur's wasn't. And he was taken back to his home to be buried. On the 12th day of his quote-unquote death, he was lying on the funeral pyre, and he returned to life. And he told the others what he had seen. He claimed he went on a great journey with a large company. And they came to a place with two openings in the earth that were close to each other, and then over them were two openings in the heavens that were close to each other. In the space in between, there were two judges, and after they gave judgment to the souls, the dead could either ascend to the heavens, or if they had been unjust in their life, they could descend into the underworld. Same old. was told to hang back in order to report on his experience back to humankind.
Oh, they were like, you tell people what's up. All right, we'll let you off.
We're gonna send you back so everyone knows what happened.
It took them 12 days to tell him that.
It was a journey.
Strangely. That's true.
He had to travel here. I'm leaving out a lot of the traveling for our podcast sake,
gotcha.
But it
gotcha.
Takes some time to get from place to place.
Gotcha.
So, remember how I said there were two openings in the sky?
Yes.
So souls were floating from the other opening in the sky that were clean, and they recounted wonderful sights and feelings. Now, souls were also coming up from the underground, from the other opening, and they were dirty, talking about the awful experiences that they'd had. And they had been punished for crimes that they had committed in their lives.
This is like classic kind of Christian-sounding heaven and hell.
Isn't
it? It's really
it?
Interesting.
Yeah,
in
from
ancient
Plato.
Greece.
And the worst, the murderers and the tyrants could never be released.
Oh,
it's going to get different from the Christians in a second, though.
Yeah.
Just you wait.
Yeah.
So and the souls then traveled. This is where some of the time comes in,
the 12 days that he was dead for.
And they get to the shaft of the brightest rainbow he's ever seen. And there's the goddess Necessity, who is basically the most powerful god creature in the ancient Greek religion that when it comes to fates and the fates of the others. And she was very highly respected by the gods and by humans because of that.
Gotcha.
And her daughters, the Fates, who we actually talked about. Carve the Mark. And they allowed the souls through a lottery to choose their next life.
Oh, really?
And observed that those who've been in the sky chose usually a more evil life, per se, or like
they
a dictator.
They just want to try it out.
Yeah, and those who had been in the underworld tended to choose a better life.
Oh, wow.
And people were kind of choosing the opposite of what they had been. Animals would choose to be humans, and humans would choose the easier life of animals. Each soul was assigned a guardian spirit to help them through their life, and then they were required to drink from the river of forgetfulness so that they would forget everything that they just experienced. And then when they went to sleep at night, the soul was lifted into the direction of their rebirth.
Having a guardian spirit and drinking from the river of forgetfulness has a lot to do with the OA.
With the OA, right?
Yeah.
And didn't remember his journey back, but he opened his eyes and found he was about to be burned.
I was like, hold up. Everyone stop.
Yeah, so that's the first NDE in Western literature.
That's fascinating to know that the ancient Greeks were, it always surprises me, but maybe it shouldn't, that like, oh, these ideas and things have been talked about before in ancient civilizations, because humans are humans and have been humans.
And have been having the same experience for thousands of years.
And why wouldn't they be fascinated with death and what happens?
And near-death experiences.
Yeah.
Exactly. There are other written accounts of near-death experiences throughout time, but the oldest medical description is from a French physician in 1740. Pierre-Jean Dumanchot describes it in his book, Antidotes de Médecine, and he speculated that too much blood flow to the brain could explain the mystical feelings people reported after coming back to consciousness. In his book, he describes a case where a patient, who was a famous apothecary in Paris, who was unconscious, afterwards said he saw a light so pure and bright that he thought he was in heaven. Now, Manchot compared this patient to others who had similar experiences with different causes. So drowning, hypothermia, hanging were some of the causes.
That bright light thing.
Mm-hmm. It's cool.
It is cool.
Really fascinating. Modern research on near-death experiences is pretty much agreed to have begun in 1975 when Raymond A. Moody Jr., a philosopher turned psychiatrist, published Life After Life, which is the book the OA based a lot of its research on.
Exactly, yeah. I'm mentioning that in my own segment, that was a big part of them choosing near-death experiences.
Right, and it's interviews with around 50 people who have experienced near-death experiences. He believed that the consciousness, or the soul, could exist in a non-material form, independent but closely connected to the brain, and that NDEs proved it.
That's really interesting, especially from like a scientist's perspective.
Right. And I consider myself a pretty grounded person.
I'm not empirical sort of gal.
Yeah. I'm not particularly spiritual.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're reading this and my quote unquote logical brain is like, okay, really,
whatever,
buddy? But people who agree with this theory have distinguished careers at universities and at hospitals, are scientists.
Yeah.
So it is a highly respected theory.
And Moody did talk to a bunch of people who experienced NDEs.
Right. Well, now I'm going to get into the problem with studying NDEs, and that's that most of these studies are retrospective. And this is a problem because the subjects are usually self-selecting, so they're not representative of every near-death experience. Also, interviews usually happen years after the fact, so memories can be off. Also, it's impossible to get reliable data on what was actually happening to the subjects' bodies and brains at the time because it happened in the past. And there's not usually a lot of, you know, documentation on exactly what happened to their body.
And that's a big part of the OA, being that there's a character in it who is trying to scientifically measure near-death experiences
right.
in a controlled environment.
And that goes back to your question, what defines a near-death experience, what medical conditions define it.
Yeah.
I didn't see any specific medical conditions that define it because it's so hard to pin it down.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to have actual controlled research.
Yeah. Is it no pulse? Is it no brain activity? Mm-hmm. Is it, you know, brain activity with no pulse? It's confusing.
Right. And researchers do try and do studies in hospitals with emergency survivors, but it's very hard to have that controlled.
Yeah,
you know,
control environment.
Not all emergency survivors have NDEs. And then those that do, measuring the conditions around them and what they saw is a very tricky thing to do.
Yeah. While you're trying to save their lives.
Exactly. Or ushering them in afterwards and trying to ask them these questions.
Yeah, yeah.
Could be an invasive thing.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to go over to a list of scientific reasons near-death experiences could be happening. And I want it to be noted that people who have experienced NDEs usually find these reasons unsatisfying.
Because their NDE meant so much to them.
Exactly. Oxygen shortage, which is usually a result of a cardiac arrest, and that can lead to disorientation, confusion, or hallucinations. A glitch in the temporal parietal junction, which is the part of the brain that integrates data from all the senses and organs, and that plays a big role in your perception of your body.
Okay.
Too much carbon dioxide. Neurochemicals could trigger hallucinations.
Like DMT, right?
Mm-hmm. But the thing is, NDEs happen when none of the above explanations have gone on. And also, the above explanations happen, and a lot of times, no NDE happens. So it's not consistent.
That's very, very interesting. I can see why the creators of the OA were like, this is cool. We should make a show that kind of features this.
Right. And they ask the big question that NDE researchers right now are asking is there a boundary between life and death, or a separation between the spirit and the body? A really fun thing, and I want to link to this on the Facebook page, Bruce Grayson, who was also one of the first doctors to study near-death experiences, in 1983 developed a scale that rated the intensity of the experience on 16 separate counts, some of them, just to name a few, joy, encountering spiritual beings, a sense of being separated from the body. And he has a scale, and it assigns a score of 0 to 2 for each count, the max score being 32. 7 or higher is classified as an NDE, and the average is about 15. So you can rate your experience.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's really fun. Obviously, NDEs are mired with controversy. An example, in 2014, do you remember the movie Heaven is for Real?
No.
Okay, it was about a boy who told his parents that he had visited heaven while he was having emergency surgery. The movie made $91 million in the U.S. It was based on the book, The Boy Who Came Back from Heaven, that was published in 2010 and sold over 10 million copies. And later, the boy admitted that he made it up.
Really? I remember the movie Flatliners with Kiefer Sutherland, Kevin Bacon, and Julia Roberts. And it's about these doctors who kill themselves and then bring themselves back to like explore, you know, what's beyond. It's kind of a cheese. It's like it's 80s, very 80s. So it's like it's not. It doesn't go as in depth.
It doesn't sound like it's taking itself as seriously as Heaven is for Real. This was marketed as proving heaven is real.
When I saw Flatliners, I thought for sure that was real. Kevin Bacon was just magnificent.
You know, I haven't seen it, so I can't comment. That's my segment. Kyle, I want to hear how the OA researched near-death experiences. I should say the OA creators.
First of all, Claire, I think that was one of the coolest segments we've ever had on our show. That was really interesting. And aww. I love NDEs.
Thanks, Kyle.
Like talking about that. And it makes sense that these guys would like read a little bit about NDEs and then be like, oh, we should, you know, make this a center focus of a show. So the OA was created by Britt Marling and Zal Batmanglitch, as we mentioned at the top of the program. And they met at Georgetown University in the early 2000s and have been working together ever since. So they went to college together and have just been collaborating since they met. They first met when Marling saw Batmanglitch's student film at Georgetown and asked if she could work with him in the future. And one of the funny things is that neither of them were at Georgetown to study film or acting. Batmanglitch was there studying anthropology and English, while Marling was there studying economics.
Yeah, I read that she was top of her class at Georgetown.
She was
too.
Valedictorian.
Yeah.
She graduated valedictorian. She also studied studio art, but once again, not acting.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
Seeing this movie, and I've seen some of her other films, it makes sense that she would study studio art and economics.
Yeah. There's actually a good commencement speech that she gives from the 2013 graduating class at Georgetown that we'll post on the Facebook page. It's good. As commencement speeches often are. But Zal Batmanglitch ended up taking a screenwriting course where he met a longtime collaborator and friend, Mike Cahill. Now, Mike Cahill, Zal Batmanglitch, and Britt Marling would pretty much be, it seems like, the best friends forever trio, and they work together a lot, and we'll get into that. But Batmanglitch did eventually study film at the American Film Institute Conservatory in Los Angeles, and where his thesis film, he had Marling star. Now, Marling, on the other hand, turned down a job at Goldman Sachs after interning there for a summer and moved to Cuba with Cahill to help write and shoot a documentary called Boxers and Ballerinas, which came out in 2004. So she had worked at Goldman Sachs, and she was like, you know.
Did the complete opposite.
Yeah.
Moved.
Ran away to Cuba.
Yeah, ran away as an American to Cuba in 2004.
To shoot a documentary, which is really interesting. And she mentions that, like, her working in finance was always kind of the plan B. Like, if she had her choice, she would have done something in the arts. But her parents were so, like, you got to focus on your future that she, you know, she went into economics and did the Goldman Sachs thing. Yeah, and decided,
did very well at it.
Yeah. And decided that, you know what, this isn't for me. And I need that fulfillment of something more artistic. An artiste we have on our hands, Claire. They would later move to Los Angeles, where Batmanglitch was living and, you know, in a film school after they'd shot this documentary.
I like the weather and the locales they're choosing to live.
Yeah, they're choosing some nice, bright, sunny, warm places. You know my opinions on Los Angeles, though. No one should live there.
Yes, I know.
There's no water.
Who needs it when you're so comfortable and warm?
I think you look out for that, Claire. In 2009, Marlene and Batman Glitch joined a freegan group, actually, and lived in tents and dumpster dove for food for a period of time.
What's freegan group?
Freegans, they're like vegans, freegans. They don't want to leave any carbon footprint or anything around, and so they'll dumpster dive for food, and they kind of like live off the land and the waste of other people.
Oh, okay.
You know, so they slept in a tent, they dumpster dove, and Marlene says it helped her kind of search for fulfillment and meaning in her life, which is one of the reasons she left that Goldman Sachs job, is that it was just like not fulfilling enough. So I
polar opposite.
Let me go live in a tent and dumpster dive for food. One of my first dates with an old girlfriend was actually dumpster diving.
And it worked out?
Yeah, for a while. Yeah, we went to Dunkin' Donuts, got some donuts. We hit up Panera.
Oh, God.
We found a lot of really crazy stuff behind the Best Buy, too, in Western Maryland.
One of your first dates?
This was our first date, yeah.
Wow, way to do a cheap date, Kyle.
Claire is now sad to be recording in a small space with me.
Not sad. I guess impressed.
So, yeah, so people do it. And Marlene, she did the freegan thing for a while. And so did Batman Glitch. Now, in 2011, Marlene co-wrote, co-produced, and acted in Batman Glitch's film Sound of My Voice and Cahill's film Another Earth. So she did the writing, co-writing, co-producing, and acting in both of those for both of those guys. Mm-hmm. Now, you've seen Sound of My
Voice,
right,
Claire?
I've seen both of them. Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. I really like Another Earth.
Yeah. Reading about them made me really want to see them. Now, I want to mention here Marlene's propensity to write parts for her to act in, because she's like always like co-producing and co-writing a lot of the stuff she does. And she mentions that it comes from an aversion to a lot of the roles she was offered when she first moved to L.A. and was auditioning. She says when she moved to L.A., a lot of the roles for women were kind of murder or abuse victims, or they were kind of stereotyped roles. And she even turned down a bunch of offers to appear in horror films, as like the blonde screaming chick who probably gets murdered and,
Or gets tortured.
And it's funny that she mentions that, that's the murder victim or the abuse victim is something she wanted to kind of get away from. Because in the OA,
she is a victim.
She is a victim, but she has more agency and she kind of is healing other people, too. It's interesting. It's like she plays a victim, but it's not the victim that you would normally see on TV, I think. Now, I want to mention Batman Glitch's Sound of My Voice because it has a lot of parallels to the OA. And actually, one reviewer said that it's kind of like it feels like a prequel to the OA. Do you remember it much, Claire?
I do. Well, I actually watched the trailer because I have a very faulty memory.
Gotcha.
But yeah, it's the idea of perception. And is this person all that they say that they are?
Because that is a part of the OA. We mentioned that, she's telling the story of her captivity and you start to question whether or not, like how true that is, the story that she's telling. Now, in Sound of My Voice, she's playing a cult leader from the future. Mm-hmm. And you don't think she's, she's a cult leader, so you think she's, full of it. But then things start to look like,
questioning. She could be real.
Yeah. So that's one of the parallels with it. Another parallel with the OA was the unreliable storyteller, which we just mentioned, but a woman healing people through stories. And they also both feature a very elaborate like body movement. Apparently in Sound of My Voice, there's a very elaborate secret handshake to get into the cult.
Yeah.
In the OA, there's the whole interpretive dance thing, which we'll get to later. I thought was a little silly at times.
You had to really be in it to ride with the interpretive dance.
But the movement looked cool. Now back to the OA, they did base a lot of their show's visual representation of the afterlife, quote unquote, on real NDEs, and they cite the book that you mentioned, the 1975 Life After Life by psychologist Raymond Moody, who interviewed a bunch of people who had NDE experiences. Marlene also mentions a girl she met at a party who had had an NDE experience and how inspirational she was to talk to.
I'm sure she was. When I was doing research on these people, it just sounded like, if you really believe that's what happened, how much it would change your life and how it would affect you and how you interacted with people.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's such an intense experience to go through. I feel like it's hard to not always have that be a constant presence in your life after you've had a near-death experience. Now, one of the funny things about the OA is when it was dropped onto Netflix was it was kind of dropped without preamble. You know, there was really no promotion for it. There was like a trailer that came out a couple days before the series actually dropped, and it wasn't really talked about. And Batman Glitch and Marlon were asked about the kind of secrecy behind it in an interview. And they said the secrecy and lack of promotion for the OA, it kind of happened organically. I have a quote from Batman Glitch from a Esquire piece published by Emma Dibden back in December. And he says, "I don't think we ever thought about marketing, but we certainly did think about mystery. We were interested in the similarity between novels and long-form television, and we wanted to approach this more like you would write in a novel. You certainly wouldn't have all your main characters in the first chapter of a novel, and you wouldn't have a nuclear reactor of a story engine in the first chapter of a novel either. And like a novel, we did want it to climax precisely at the end, not just sort of finish up the storyline for the first year, but really have it be a transformative experience." That they didn't, you know, it was a mystery show. So as they were making it, the fact that it was just kind of mysteriously being put out there.
Which is so funny because I don't remember it coming out, but I remember all of a sudden everyone was talking about it. And people who I work with who don't watch sci-fi had watched the OA.
Yeah. My girlfriend, who isn't really into sci-fi, likes the OA. Like, she's into it. So it does kind of transcend barriers, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when Marlon and Batman Glitch pitched their idea of the OA to different studios, they had a hard time summarizing the story. So they wrote it out as a play, and they would actually act out the story, playing all the parts. And apparently it was a process that would take hours.
It sounds like a comedy sketch.
It does.
Or like something you would see in a movie, that it would just be a montage.
Yeah.
And just studio executives falling asleep and or
yeah,
just staring off at a table.
So, I know, so much for like the quick elevator pitch of like, all right, what's your idea? Give it to me fast. I'm like, no, this is it.
Did they pitch it as a TV show originally?
They did pitch it as a TV show, yes. And it was, in the end, it was Brad Pitt's Plan B Entertainment that was kind of sold on the idea and helped push the show towards Netflix. Now, the creators, they say they certainly do have a future for the show planned out, and they know how it's going to end, so don't be too worried. I mean, people were a little upset by the finale of the OA, which I guess we'll talk about in our opinion section. But it's not like Lost, which, you know, went nowhere. I feel like Lost is really...
But Lost had 6 seasons of buildup.
That's true.
This was
That's
just
true.
8 episodes.
I personally feel like Lost traumatized a bunch of people for shows that just go nowhere. I'd say Lost and Battlestar Galactica.
Mm-hmm.
But the show has received largely positive reviews, and it has a 73% critic score and a 74% audience score on Rotten Tomatoes.
And a whole lot of buzz.
A lot of people are talking about it because it is very labyrinthine. So, Claire, you've seen a lot of their other work, Batman Glitch and Marlon. What'd you think of the OA?
Yeah, I was the one who really pushed that we do this topic because I really liked their earlier movies. They are really different, really cool. And I think that I like that they do indie movies that are sci-fi.
Yeah.
Because that's not something indie movies usually touch. I really wanted to like it, and I was very impressed with a lot of parts of it, but I actually prefer them as movie makers, not as TV makers. I think they do better when they have to make the story more concise, because I thought that parts of the show were a little bit drawn out.
Yeah.
What did you think?
I liked it, and finishing the show, I was like, it's okay. But in retrospect, like since we've been in here to record, it makes me like it more, actually. Like, distance makes it more appealing to me right now.
Also, learning about
NDEs yeah,
and also the amount of work that they put into the show. Last week with Carve the Mark, it was something that felt not very well researched or thought out. And
yeah,
this, I didn't love it, but I was impressed with how much had gone into it. And I don't doubt that these are people who are trying to cover all of their bases when it comes
definitely
to these topics.
There is a lot of craft and a lot of care in each episode, and you can tell just like the shots are beautiful. We're not going to spoil the show, but we are going to talk a little bit about maybe what happens in the first couple episodes.
First 2 or 3 episodes, because so much comes in.
Yeah.
The
first depiction of the afterlife of the NDE that Prairie goes through, I think, is one of the coolest things I ever saw. And that's what kind of got me to finish the show, was because I wanted more of that. And I just wish there was a bit more of the afterlife experience.
Right. And Kyle and I have talked about this. There's 2 stories in the OA. There's the story that Prairie is telling And then there's the story that's happening in the present in the town that she's come back to where her parents live.
Yeah.
And I was so much more interested in the story that she was telling.
Me too.
And I wanted them to focus on that. And that's kind of where the mystical NDE element comes in.
Yeah. The other story. So there's the story that she's telling about her captivity. And then there's the story of just her back in this town kind of adopting a group of misfits. And you're right, that's a little less compelling to me anyway. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be more in that captivity.
On the other hand, I think that might help make its audience bigger.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, for people who aren't like us, aren't as cool as us, they might be more interested in just people living in this town.
Yeah, the misfits, the high school misfits that she kind of takes in. You know, there is that kind of high school drama aspect to it.
Also, what kind of blew my mind was the caliber of talent that they had acting in this. Riz Ahmed, you might know him from Star Wars, Rogue One.
He was in Rogue One. Yeah, he was the pilot who defected from the Empire. He was also in The Night Of, that HBO show.
That HBO show that I haven't seen, but a lot of people have talked about and said it's really good. He is so good in this, and it's not a big part, but he's super good.
Yeah. I feel weird talking about acting and things because I'm not an actor and it feels strange for me to like try and critique acting. But I did believe a lot of these characters. The one person who I was lukewarm to until kind of the middle of the end was Britt Marling herself, who played Prairie, the kind of the main character.
Yeah.
I was like, on her in the beginning. But I warmed up to her as the show went on.
You know, she starts telling the story by telling her childhood. And I really loved the actress that played young Prairie.
Yeah, the little like 5-year-old girl.
Yeah,
she was
really good. And then when we got to Britt Marling, I was like, oh, I kind of liked younger you better.
Could we maybe age the little girl with the CGI and maybe put her?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I know how you love the CGI, Kyle.
Yes, I love
that. But also, Jason Isaacs, he plays the antagonist. He has been in so much. He's Lucius Malfoy in Harry Potter.
Lucius Malfoy. He's the evil British guy in The Patriot.
He's kind of the evil guy in just about everything. Yeah. If you saw him, you'd know him. He's in this. Scott Wilson, who plays Prairie's dad, I thought he was great.
Yeah.
Sissy Spacek is in this. And Phyllis from The Office.
Phyllis from The Office. Phyllis Smith, yeah, is her actual
name.
She's
great.
She is good.
But I wonder if because it was Brad Pitt's production company that they were able to get these big names.
Well, I think Baum and Glitch and Marlene had established themselves as credible indie directors.
They're kind of indie darlings.
Yeah, they're indie darlings. So if you were a bit of a big name actor and you wanted to work on something a little bit smaller scale instead of the blockbusters, I think they're a great choice to go with. So you liked the show, Claire?
Would you
recommend it, I guess is what I'm asking.
I think it's worth checking out and seeing.
If
it's up your alley. I don't know if I would have kept watching if we weren't doing it for the podcast, which really disappointed me because, like I said, I'm big fans of theirs.
Yeah.
I like their movies, and I really wanted to love this.
Yeah. I also agree that I didn't love it, but I'm good. Definitely going to watch a second season because I'm so curious about where the story goes. And I really love the source material that they were pulling from of the NDEs and stuff. I think it's fascinating. And there's not a show out there that really focuses on it. The last thing I mentioned before was Flatliners with Kevin Bacon. And it's kind of 80s and cheesy.
Or Heaven is for Real.
Heaven is for Real, which I've never seen. But I'm just going to say that Phyllis Smith and the OA is definitely greater than Kevin Bacon and Flatliners.
Oh, wow. It's heavy praise, Kyle.
Watch Flatliners and you'll see
Never mind. I will definitely watch the first episode of the second season.
Just to see what's up.
See what's up.
Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And I'm Claire White.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com, and we would love it if you could rate and review us on iTunes. You can find the show on Twitter at dsrapodcast. I can be found on Twitter at klex303, that's KLEX303.
I can be found at Along With Claire, that's CLAIRE.
And you can find our producer James at James Fowey Jr., that's James Fowey, FOUHEYJR. You can learn more about the OA on our Facebook page, where we will be posting some of our show notes.
Also, we'd love to hear if you've had an NDE.
Please.
Please tell us. Or also, what did you think of the OA, and did you like the ending?
Yeah, that's a very good question. not a very popular ending. Our producer, who, if all goes according to plan, will have an NDE this very evening, is James Foey. Our logo was done by Patty Hyland, the DSRA Afterlife Spirit Guide. And our theme was composed by Pete Rowan, who, if he does have an NDE, I don't think he's going to see a light at the end of the tunnel. He's going to see a chipwitch at the end of the tunnel. Once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.